Chapter 21. The Moog spends the next couple of hours trying to wheedle information out of me, alternating between taunting me and trying to frighten me. I adopt a strict policy of silence, and eventually he gives up. But I know it's not over. We ride on in silence. I stare at Maddie. She never once looks up at me. If what the Moog told me is true, and it must be, or otherwise Maddie would have defended herself, then she's been playing me since I first saw her. The connection I felt between us was just a sham, something I let myself believe because of how desperate and lonely I was. I was so stupid to believe that a girl like Maddie would be interested in me. And yet, the more I study Maddie's face, the more I'm able to convince myself that maybe it wasn't all just some Moog trick. She looks terrified, like she's stuck in a nightmare that refuses to end. But it isn't just terror that keeps her from looking at me. That's guilt. She wouldn't feel guilty if there had never been anything at all between us, would she? Sander was right. I've been acting like a child. I know the responsible thing to do is to remain silent, to keep up my air of detachment until a way to escape presents itself. But I need to know the truth. Did you ever like me? I ask Maddie. Maddie cringes when I speak. The Moog claps his hands, delighted, but I ignore him. Slowly, Maddie raises her head to look at me.
I'm sorry, she stammers. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to know you better.
How romantic,
quips the Moog, and then he grabs Maddie roughly by the shoulders, shoving a black hood over her head.
You're next, lover boy, says the Moog, yanking a hood over my head as well.
I never have a chance to ask Maddie what she meant. Sitting in the dark, I try to put myself in Maddie's position. What would I do if the Moogs had taken Sander hostage and forced me to work for them? I'd kill them all, of course, but that really wasn't an option for Maddie. I don't blame Maddie, I realize. How could she have done anything different? She had no idea what was really at stake. I can still fix this. I can escape, and I'll bring Maddie with me. It doesn't matter what she did. I know she's not the real enemy here. The van stops, and the Moogs pull me and Maddie out. We stumble along in darkness, at first over rough terrain that I take for the woods, and then over metal grates that cause our footsteps to echo loudly. Wherever the Moogs have taken us, it sounds cavernous and busy, activity reverberating around us. For a while, I keep track of Maddie's footsteps as she staggers behind me. But at some point, the Moogs yank her in a different direction. They prod me onward, forcing me to shuffle awkwardly with my shackled ankles across narrow catwalks and down endless hallways. Finally, we stop. The large Moog from the van yanks the hood off my head, ripping out a few strands of my hair in the process. We're in a dark room with no furniture or distinguishing features to speak of, only a single large window cut out of one wall. Some other Moogs have gathered there, most of them leering at me, others excitedly peering out the window.
I thought you'd like to see this, says the Moog, dragging me by the elbow over to the window.
The room is some kind of observatory. Outside the window, below us, I see Maddie walking through a large, empty room. Seeing her alone down there, my stomach begins to churn. A door at the opposite end of the room hisses open, and a middle-aged man and woman step slowly into view. They both look thin and dirty. The man is particularly haggard, one sleeve of his yellowed dress shirt actually ripped off and tied around his forehead in a crude bandage. The woman has to partially support him as the pair walk toward Maddie.
We promised we'd reunite her with her parents when she brought us to you, muses the Moog. A job well done, I'd say.
Maddie races across the room, nearly bowling over her parents when she reaches them. They hug, and I can see, even from this distance, that they are all crying. I press my forehead to the glass, wishing I could be down there with them.
However, says the Moog, we never said we'd let them leave.
I hear the beast before I see it. a ferocious roar rattling the walls around us. The Moogs on either side of me shift in excitement as the creature lumbers into view. Sander told me about the Piken and the role they played in the destruction of Lorien, but I've never seen one in person. The Piken is as big as a truck, with a body that would resemble an ox if not for the two extra legs and row of twisted spikes that curve down its spine. Its head is snake-like and narrow, its slavering mouth filled with crooked fangs. Maddie's father sees the Piken first. He tries to put himself between his family and the beast, but he's too weak. He collapses onto one knee before the Piken has even begun to circle. Maddie is looking up at the observatory window. I'm not sure if she can see me. She waves her arms and screams. It's hard to hear exactly what she's saying through the thick glass, but I think it's, "You promised!" over and over. And then, as the Piken lunges forward, her words change. This time I have no problem reading her lips. "Stanley!" Maddie screams. "Help us!" I throw up. My mouth tastes like bile. I sink down to my knees, humiliated, turning my head away from the gruesome scene below. The Moogs laugh and cheer. This is like sport to them. The big one pats my shoulder companionably.
"If it's any consolation," he says, "pretty soon, that will be you down there."
Chapter 22. My life becomes push-ups and silence. The Moogs have stuck me in a small cell and seem to have forgotten me. There's no night and day here, and as best as I can tell, they only feed me when they feel like it. Keeping track of the time becomes impossible, so I do push-ups. On the floor, on the walls, on the ceiling, wherever I can in my tiny prison. I think about Sander. I have faith that he's still out there looking for me. One day he'll find me. We will break out of here, and I will kill every Moog that dares stand in my way. I thought I was in good shape before, but I'm getting bigger and stronger. I can tell by the way the Moogs who bring my food keep a careful distance that I intimidate them. I'm glad. Let them think about what's coming when I get out of here. I hope they dream about it, like I do. Sometimes, the large Moog who captured me, or one of the other important-looking ones, stops by my cell to ask me some vague question. Where have I hidden my transmission device? What do I know about Spain? I never answer. I haven't spoken since my first day here. I grunt and growl and show them my teeth. Let them think that I've gone crazy, that captivity has turned me into some kind of animal. Maybe it has. When I sleep, the nightmares come. They feel as real as the vision I had of Lorien, but offer none of the comfort. In them, an enormous Mogadorian, covered in heinous tattoos and scars, points a golden weapon shaped like a giant hammer in my direction. On the flat part is painted a black eye that pulses when aimed at me, creating a sensation like having my guts scooped out. Somehow, I know who this giant monster is. Cetricus Ra, my enemy. Sleeping is bad, but sometimes being awake is even worse. These are days where I feel like I can't breathe. It feels as if the entire cavernous prison is sitting on top of me. The need to escape becomes primal then, and I throw myself against the glowing blue force field activated in front of the steel door of my cell, an extra layer of protection, letting it buffet me across the tiny space until I'm too exhausted to do it again. The nausea sets in then. I learn to fight through it. Each time I hit the force field, it hurts a little less. I try not to think about Maddie. One day, the Moogs take me out of my cell. If I had to guess, I'd say that it has been months since I came here. They lead me to a different cell, where they place me behind another blue force field. The large Moog from the van is in the room, seated on what I immediately recognize as a Loric chest. My Loric chest.
"We found him in Ohio," says the Moog matter-of-factly. snooping around the office of a little newsletter we've been keeping under surveillance. Looking for you.
He presses a button, and a panel in the back of the cell rises. My heart stops when I see what's behind it. It's Sander. My Sepan hangs upside down from the ceiling. He's been badly beaten. Both of his eyes are blackened, his lips swollen, his torso marred by grisly slashes. Perhaps worst of all, they have torn out chunks of his usually perfectly maintained hair and left his finely tailored suit in tatters. He is not at all the man I remember. They've destroyed him. My eyes fill with tears, but I fight them back. Sander sucks in a breath when he sees me. I wonder how different I must look to him after these months of captivity. It's hard to say with his face so swollen and covered in bruises, but Sander looks almost happy. I'm ashamed of myself, both because it's my fault we've been captured, and because I'm so powerless.
My young ward, he whispers.
The Moog turns to me. He's holding a wicked-looking dagger.
Your little vow of silence routine has been fun, the Moog says to me. But it ends today.
He walks over to Sander and lightly drags the dagger down his sternum.
I don't think you know anything, muses my captor. Nothing that we don't know already, at least, he shrugs. But I'm going to torture your Sepan anyway, until you ask me to stop.
He wants to break me. I say nothing. I remember Sander's lectures on what to do if the unthinkable should happen and I'm captured. Don't give them anything, he told me. Even the slightest bit of information could hurt the other guard who are still in hiding. Don't let them make you weak. I hope it's not too late to make Sander proud. I stare into Sander's eyes. He stares back until the Moog begins making his cuts, precise, surgical slices that must hurt like hell, but aren't deep enough to kill. My Sepan clenches his eyes shut. When the Moog is finished, Sander has passed out from the pain, and a pool of blood has collected on the cell floor beneath him. I keep my silence. The next day, it starts over. I keep my body rigid and my mouth shut. When Sander can manage to focus on me, I think that I see pride in his eyes. This continues for days. After every session, the Moogs return me to my cell, where I shake uncontrollably until the routine starts over again. When they take Sander's fingers off, I have to turn away. At the next session, the Moog hums tunelessly while he cuts away at Sander. My Sepan flits in and out of consciousness. I wait for him to make eye contact with me, before I finally speak. I'm sorry for everything, I croak, my voice like gravel after months of disuse. The Moog spins to face me, stunned.
What did you say?
Barely able to move, Sander can manage only a subtle shake of his head, as if to absolve me of all the mistakes that led us here. I don't find any peace in forgiveness, but maybe Sander does in the forgiving. Sander closes his eyes, and something in me snaps. Mustering every bit of strength I have, I hurl myself against the force field, ignoring the pain. There's a buzz and a crackle, and then the sound of a small explosion, and I find myself sprawled on the floor of the room, looking up at the Mogadorians, whose monstrous faces betray their shock at what I've managed to do. I've disabled the force field. I'm through. I know I only have a second to act before the element of surprise wears off. I push through overwhelming dizziness and nausea and try to use my telekinesis to wrest the dagger from the Moog's hand, but nothing happens. The field must have somehow zapped my legacies. For now, I'll have to rely on the part of me that's human. Normal. The Moogs lunge for me, but I'm ready for them. I kick the first one in the stomach, knocking the wind out of him and sending him flying, and yank the other one's ankles, pulling his legs out from under him. His head makes a loud crack against the floor, and I jump to my feet. They're both knocked out, but not for long. I grab the dagger from the floor where the Mogadorian from the van dropped it, and I'm contemplating which one to kill first when I hear a grunt from behind me.
It's Sander.
No,
he mutters. I spin around to face him. His eyes are open again, and it seems like he's using every bit of energy he has to speak.
Not them,
he says.
It won't do any good. There will just be more.
Then what? I ask. My voice catches in my throat. This isn't fair. It wasn't how it was supposed to be. What should I do?
You know what you have to do, he says.
I can't. I won't.
You've always known I would die for you. That I would die for Lorien.
I almost argue with him, but there's no time. The Moogs behind me are beginning to come too. I know he's right. And I know what I must do. I take the dagger and plunge it deep into Sander's heart. My Sapon is dead. I barely know what's happening as they pull me off him and drag me back to my cell. They're yelling at me, screaming really, madder than I've ever seen them. But it's like they're speaking another language. I have no idea what they're saying, and I don't care. It was mercy, what I did. The last bit of mercy left in me. There will be none left when I get my chance again. Chapter 23 The Moogs leave me to rot in my cell. The only contact comes in the form of the occasional tray of slop under my door. I try to bust through the force field again and again, but it doesn't work this time. They must have increased its strength. They're afraid of me. I don't blame them. Sometimes, I'm a little afraid of me too. I cling to the memories of Sander and Maddie, reliving their last moments. I feel the rage bubble up inside me, and my mind shuts off. When I return to myself, I'm sweating, my knuckles bloodied, chips of stone hacked out of the walls of my cell. I've forgiven Maddie, but I haven't forgiven myself. There's nothing else to do but wait, remember, and get stronger. And then one day, it happens. I can tell something is going wrong. There's a rumbling from below that causes dust to fall from the ceiling. I can hear large groups of Moogs running by my door, voices raised in panic. Wrong for the Moogs could mean right for me. I feel a rush of energy like I haven't felt since the first time Sander let me loose in the lecture hall. I can't keep my fists from clenching and unclenching. I walk as close to the door as I can without triggering the bubbling force field. I feel like those bulls at the rodeos right before they're let free from their pens. When the force field flickers and disappears, I almost can't believe it. The sickly blue light has been a fixture of my world for so long that it takes my mind a moment to adjust to its absence. There's a voice on the other side of my door. It's not a Mogadorian voice. It's a teenage one. I don't know what he's asking, and I don't care. Shut up and stand back, kid! I tear the door loose and throw it into the hall. I'm stronger than I remember being. Part of the ceiling collapses with its impact, and I can see the larger of the two boys in the hall focus, using his own telekinesis to shield himself and his friend from the rubble. A guard. It's about time. A dorky-looking runt is pointing a gun at me. His hands are shaking badly. The guard gets a good look at me and drops the two chests that he's carrying. One of them is mine. What number are you? He asks. I'm 4. I study him. For some reason, I expected the other guard to be bigger. 4 has to be about my age, yet he seems so much younger. Younger and softer. I shake his hand. I'm 9. Good job staying alive, number 4. 4 and the other boy, a human named Sam, explain to me what they're doing here while I rummage through my chest. I'm not really listening until they get to Sam's story. His father missing, possibly taken by Moogs. I wish I could save him. I wish I could save everyone. But I can't. And who was there to save Maddie? Who was there to save Sander? I fish a stone out of my chest that I remember Sander using when he was deconstructing a particularly complicated machine. It let him see through parts, into their inner workings.
It should allow Sam to see through walls, maybe find his father. All he needs is a little juice. I press my thumb to Sam's forehead, sharing my power with him. You've got about 10 minutes. Get to it. He takes off down the hall. And that's when the Moogs finally come. They stream down the corridor. I pluck my pipe staff out of the chest and rush to meet them. I spring up the wall, along the ceiling, moving faster than I can remember moving before. They don't even see me coming until I've dropped among them, impaling two of them on the end of the staff. I've waited so long for this. I feel giddy as I tear my way through the Moogs, caving in a skull here, crushing a sternum there. I whirl through their ranks, spinning my pipe staff as I go. Was the Moog that captured me and tortured Sander in that first group? It doesn't matter. They all die the same. I'll get him now or I'll get him later. I don't realize that I'm laughing until the bitter taste of Mogadorian ash fills my mouth. I savor it. The skirmish is over too soon. I'm sprinting along the wall back to Four and Sam in seconds, trailing a cloud of ash. I want more. We have to go, says Four. I don't want to go. I want to tear this place apart. Yet something tells me that I should listen to this boy, that we should stick together. It's what Sander would want. We have to fight our way out. My mind shuts off as the fighting grows more intense. At some point, I realize that Four and I have become separated from Sam. I feel bad for the kid. Another piece of human collateral damage. My sympathy is quickly drowned out by the urge to tear this entire place down. I drive my pipe staff into the neck of a piken. I'm straddling its neck as it collapses, its blood spraying me, blending with my coat of Mogadorian ash. I can taste it mixing with the coppery tang of my own blood. I'm grinning. Four stares at me aghast, like I'm only a little better than the monsters we're killing. Are you crazy? He asks. You're enjoying this? I've been locked up for over a year, I tell him. This is the best day of my life. It's true. I haven't felt this good in forever. Still, I try to downplay just how much I'm loving this. I don't want to freak Four out. For all his judgment, Four doesn't hesitate to take my hand when we need to use my anti-gravity legacy to escape. It's a long and brutal fight. When we finally catch a glimpse of daylight, I feel disappointed. I wish they'd never stop coming. I glance at Four. He's pretty beaten up, but he's killed his fair share of Moogs and Piken on the way out, even if he lacks my enthusiasm. Perhaps we'll make a warrior out of him yet. We escape from the Mogadorian base, and I greedily suck in my first breath of fresh air in more than a year. Immediately, I gag. The smell of dead animals is overwhelming. Four and I jog for the tree line. He barely makes it there, collapsing against a tree almost immediately. He's in rough shape physically, and if the tears are any indication, equally bad shape mentally. He's beating himself up over leaving Sam behind. I know a thing or two about guilt, but I don't know what the hell to say to this kid. Buck up, champ. We'll kill them next time. Everything I think of seems hollow, so I keep my mouth shut. He'll learn to shut off his emotions eventually. Emotions will get you killed. They'll get someone else killed, too. As I press a healing stone to Four's back, the sky overhead begins to writhe with an ominous-looking storm. At first, Four thinks it's Number Six coming to help us. It's not. It's Cetricus Ra. Despite seeing him in nightly visions, I'm not prepared for his true size. He's bigger than any Mogadorian I've ever seen, utterly repulsive even from this distance. The sight of the three Lorian pendants glowing around his thick neck causes me to clench my fists, fingernails digging into my palms. Suddenly, I understand exactly what Sander was training me for. This is the battle I was meant to fight. Killing Cetricus Ra is the destiny I've been chasing. Together with Four, I charge. Chapter 24. Is he okay? I ask.
He needs rest, the Chimera's kind voice says inside my mind.
Talking to animals, that's new. It's been a day of surprises. So much has happened, I don't even have time to consider my newly discovered legacy. I'll figure it out later, when things have settled down. If they ever settle down. Four stretches across the back seat of his SUV, nearly doubled over. His Chimera, named for some weak human athlete, lies next to him, gently licking his face. I'm reminded of my dream, of playing with my own Chimera, on Lorien. But I push that memory back down with all the other things I want to forget. The war has begun. I have only one purpose. The coward Cetricus Ra fled into the Mogadorian base before we could get to him. With Four getting wrecked by the force field and no way back into the base, I decided to make a strategic retreat. Ra's day will come. When I told Four that I'd stab him once for every day his people had Sander tortured, I meant it. I start the engine. It's the first time I've driven since that fateful night with Maddie. I think about the way she clutched my arm as we screamed through red lights, then discard that memory as well. So what's our next move? I ask Four.
Head north, he says. I think north would be good.
You got it, boss.
I already knew where we were heading, but it's easier not to have to convince Four. It will be good to see Chicago again. I'm pretty sure the Mogadorians never found our safe house. They would have bragged about it if they had, used it to demoralize me even more. It should still be there, on the top floor of the John Hancock building, a safe place for me to plan our next move. A place filled with painful memories I'll have to ignore. I drive north, my foot heavy on the gas. It's ironic. At last I have my freedom, but at a price. Now, my destiny is mine to choose, and I've already chosen. Today will go down as a dark day in the Mogadorian history books. It is the day that they allowed me to get loose. In whatever dismal corner of the universe the Mogadorians that managed to escape me gather, this day will be discussed in hushed tones as when the annihilation of their race became a certainty. I'm going to kill them all.
The Fallen Legacies.
Chapter 1. Sometimes I wonder what they would think if they knew we were here, right under their noses. I'm sitting with my best friend, Ivan, on the grassy, crowded National Mall, the stupid stone obelisk of the Washington Monument looming above us. I've put my homework aside for the moment, and as I watch the tourists studying their maps, the lawyers and officials scurrying obliviously down Independence Avenue to their next meeting, I'm almost amused. They're so caught up with silly fears about UV rays and chemicals in their vegetables, and meaningless terrorist threat levels, and whatever else it is that these people worry about, that it never occurs to them that two kids working on their homework in the grass are the real threat. They have no idea that there's nothing they can do to protect themselves. The true enemy is already here. Hey! I sometimes want to shout, waving my arms. I'm your future evil dictator. Tremble before me, jerks. Of course, I can't do that. Not yet. That time will come. In the meantime, they can all stare right through me as if I'm just another normal face in the crowd. The truth is, I'm anything but normal, even if I do my best to look it. On Earth, assimilation protocol demands that I be known as Adam, son of Andrew and Susanna Sutton, citizen of Washington, D.C. But that's not who I am at all. I am Adamus Sutek, son of the great general Andrakus Sutek. I am a Mogadorian. I am who they should be afraid of. Unfortunately, for now, being an alien conqueror isn't as exciting as it should be. At the moment, I'm still stuck doing my homework. My father has promised me that this won't last forever. When the Mogadorians ascend to power on this crappy little planet, I will control the capital city of the United States. Trust me. After spending the last 4 years in this place, I've got a pretty good idea of some changes I'll make. The first thing I'll do is rename all the streets. None of this Independence Constitution stuff. This weak, stupid patriotism. When I'm in charge, no one will even be able to remember what the Constitution is. When I'm in charge, my avenues will carry titles of appropriate menace. Blood of Warriors Boulevard, I murmured to myself, trying to decide if it has a good ring to it. Hard to say. Broken Sword Way. Huh? Ivan asks, glancing up from his spot on the grass next to me. He's lying on his stomach, a pencil held across his index finger like a makeshift blaster. While I dream of the day I'll be the ruler of all I survey, Ivan imagines himself as a sniper, picking off Lorik enemies as they leave the Lincoln Memorial.
What did you say?
Nothing, I reply. Ivanik Shura, son of the great warrior Bolag Shura, shrugs his shoulders. Ivan has never been much for fantasies that don't include some kind of bloody combat. His family claims a distant relation to our beloved leader, Satrakis Ra. And if Ivan's size is any indication, I'm inclined to believe them. Ivan's 2 years younger than me, but is already bigger, broad-shouldered and thick, while I am lithe and agile. He already looks like a warrior and keeps his coarse black hair cropped close, eager for the day when he'll be able to shave it off entirely and take on the ceremonial Mogadorian tattoos. I still remember the night of the first great expansion when my people conquered Lorien. I was 8 years old that night, too old to be crying, but I cried anyway when I was told I'd be staying in orbit above Lorien with the women and children. My tears only lasted a few seconds until the general slapped some sense into me. Ivan watched my tantrum, dumbly sucking his thumb, maybe too young to realize what was happening. We watched the battle from our ship's observatory with my mother and infant sister. We clapped as flames spread across the planet below us. After the fight was won and the Lorik people were destroyed, the general returned to our ship, covered in blood. Despite the triumph, his face was serious. Before saying anything to my mother or me, he knelt before Ivan and explained that his father had died in service to our race. A glorious death, befitting a true Mogadorian hero. He rubbed his thumb across Ivan's forehead, leaving a trail of blood. A blessing. As an afterthought, the general did the same to me. After that, Ivan, whose mother had died during childbirth, came to live with us and was raised as my brother. My parents are considered lucky to have 3 true-born children. I'm not always sure that my father feels lucky to have me, though. Whenever my test scores or physical evaluations are less than satisfactory, the general jokes that he might have to transfer my inheritance to Ivan. I'm mostly sure he's joking. My gaze drifts towards a family of sightseers as they cross the lawn, each of them taking in the world through digital cameras. The father pauses to snap a series of photos of the monument, and I briefly reconsider my plans to demolish it. Instead, perhaps, I could make it taller, maybe install a penthouse for myself in the uppermost floor. Ivan could have the room below mine. The daughter of the tourist family is probably about 13, like me, and she's cute, in a shy way, with a mouth full of braces. I catch her looking at me, and find myself unconsciously shifting into a more presentable position, sitting up straighter, tilting my chin down to hide the severe angle of my too large nose. When the girl smiles at me, I look away. Why should I care what some human thinks of me? We must always remember why we are here. Does it ever amaze you how easily they accept us as their own? I ask Ivan.
Never underestimate human stupidity, he says,
reaching over to tap the blank page of homework sitting next to me.
Are you going to finish this shit or what?
The homework lying next to me isn't mine, it's Ivan's. He's waiting for me to do it for him. Written assignments have always given him problems, whereas the right answers come easily to me. I glance down at the assignment. Ivan is supposed to write a short essay on a quote from the great book, the Book of Mogadorian Wisdom and Ethics, that that all of our people must learn and live by, interpreting what Setrakis Ra's writing means to him personally. We do not begrudge the beast for hunting, I read aloud, although like most of my people I know the passage by heart. It is in the beast's nature to hunt, just as it is in the Mogadorian's nature to expand. Those that would resist the expansion of the Mogadorian Empire, therefore, stand in opposition to nature itself. I look over at Ivan. He's taken aim on the family I was watching before, making high-pitched laser beam noises through gritted teeth. The girl with the braces frowns at him and turns away. What does that mean to you? I ask.
I don't know.
He grunts.
That our race is the most badass, and everyone else should deal with it.
Right? I shrug my shoulders, sighing. Close enough. I pick up my pen and start to scribble something down, but I'm interrupted by the chime of my cell phone. I figure it's a text message from my mother, asking me to pick up something from the store on my way home. She's really taken to cooking over the last couple years, and, I'll admit, the food here on Earth blows away what we used to get on Mogador. What they consider processed here would be treasured on my home planet, where food, among other things, is grown in subterranean vats. The text isn't from Mom, though. The message is from the General.
Shit,
I say, dropping my pen as if the General had just caught me helping Ivan cheat. My father never sends text messages. The act is beneath him. If the General wants something, we're supposed to anticipate what it is before he even has to ask. Something really important must have happened.
What is it?
Asks Ivan. The message reads simply, Home, now.
We have to go.
Chapter 2 Ivan and I take the metro out of D.C., pick up our bikes at the train station, and pedal into the suburbs as fast as we can. When we finally zip through the gated entrance of Ashwood Estates, I've fallen at least 30 yards behind him. I blame my sweat-dampened t-shirt on the unseasonable warmth and my feeling of nausea on the ominous text message from my father. Ashwood Estates is identical to many of the wealthy gated communities outside of Washington, or at least it looks identical. But instead of being owned by politicians and their families, the mansions and immaculately maintained lawns behind the front gates are owned by my people, the Mogadorians, Earth's soon-to-be conquerors. And the homes themselves are only a tiny part of the real Ashwood Estates. Underneath the houses is a huge maze of tunnels that connect the many Mogadorian facilities that are the true purpose of this place. I've only been granted access to small parts of our underground headquarters. I have no idea how far they extend or how deep below the earth they reach, but I know that this sprawling underground network houses many laboratories, weapons stores, training facilities, and probably more secrets than I can't yet begin to guess at. It's also down there that the Vat-born live. If it wasn't for our beloved leader, Setrakis Ra, the Mogadorian race would have never survived long enough to begin the Great Expansion. Over the last 100 years, for reasons that are still mostly unknown, it has become more and more difficult for Mogadorians to bear children. By the time Kelly was born, natural Mogadorian births were so rare that our ancient, proud species was in grave danger of dying out entirely. When children were able to be conceived, Mogadorian women, like Ivan's mother, often died during childbirth. Because of this, Setrakis Ra and a team of scientists had been working to artificially breed a new generation of Mogadorians. Rather than being birthed in the usual way, our vat-born Mogadorian brothers and sisters are grown in giant chemical vats, from which they eventually emerge, fully grown and ready for battle. These vat-born not only ensure the continued existence of Mogadorian life, but, with their heightened strength, speed, and stamina, are also the backbone of our army. Besides their increased physical prowess, the Vat-born are different from true-born Mogadorians like me in other ways, too. They've been engineered to be physically suited for war,
but to be soldiers rather than officers. In his wisdom, Satrakis Ra has created them to be more single-minded than true-born Mogadorians, almost machine-like in their adherence to the tasks they're assigned. And as natural warriors, what they have in the way of rational thought often gives way to rage and bloodlust. But the most important difference between the Vat-born and the true-born, at least here on Earth, is the fact that they look different from the rest of us. While the true-born are able to pass amid humans, the Vat-born are not. Their skin is ghostly pale from subterranean living, and their teeth are small and sharp for close combat rather than eating. This is why, until we are able to reveal ourselves, they are only rarely allowed to show their faces in daylight. So when I see the Vat-born openly celebrating on the lawns of Ashwood Estates alongside their true-born betters, I know something huge is happening. Ivan knows it too, and gives me a befuddled look as he skids to a stop in our cul-de-sac. I pull up beside him, catching my breath. All of the families of Ashwood Estates are in front of their homes, mingling with each other, raising toasts from freshly opened bottles of champagne. The Vat-born, with their jarringly pale skin hidden beneath trench coats and hats, look both excited and disoriented to be out in the open. The air of jubilation is unusual in Mogadorian culture. Normally my people are not given to open displays of joy, especially with the general in the vicinity. "What the hell is going on?" Ivan asks, as usual, looking to me for answers. This time I just shrug back at him. My mother is sitting on our front steps, watching with a small smile as Kelly dances wildly across the front yard. My sister, spinning maniacally, doesn't even notice when Ivan and I arrive. My mother looks relieved to see us approach, though I don't know what the celebration is for. I do know why she wouldn't have joined the other revelers out on the lawns and street. Being the wife of the general makes it difficult for her to make friends, even with other trueborns. Their fear of my father extends to my mother. "Boys," she says as Ivan and I roll our bikes up the front walk, "he's been looking for you. You know he doesn't like to wait." "Why does he need to see us?" I ask. Before my mother can answer, the general appears in the doorway behind her. My father is a large man, standing close to 7 feet tall, muscular, with a regal posture that demands respect. His face is all sharp angles, a feature I've unfortunately inherited from him. Since coming to Earth, he's grown his black hair out to hide the tattoos on his scalp, and he keeps it neatly slicked back, like some of the politicians I've seen striding across the National Mall.
"Adamus," he says in a tone that brooks no questioning, "come with me. You too, Ivanek."
"Yes, sir," Ivan and I reply in unison, exchanging a nervous glance with each other before stepping into the house. When my father uses that tone of voice, it means something serious is happening. As I pass, my mother gives my hand a gentle squeeze.
"Have fun in Malaysia,"
shouts Kelly at our backs, having finally noticed us.
"Kill that guard as hard as you can."
Chapter 3. A few hours later, Ivan and I are headed for Malaysia on board a cold and uncomfortable plane that was purchased as surplus from some government that doesn't ask a lot of questions. The passenger area doesn't look all that different from the cargo hold below. Just metal benches with worn seatbelts, where Ivan and I sit, crammed among the warriors. Some of them true-born, most Vat-born. Our ride isn't glamorous, but I'm too nervous to worry about comfort. This is the first time I've been taken on a mission, even if my purpose is only to observe. My father flies co-pilot. Whenever the plane's course becomes momentarily shaky, I wonder if it's a change in the atmospheric conditions or if it's just that my father's made the pilot nervous. For many of the Mogadorians on the plane, this is their first action since the first great expansion.
Some of them spend the flight reminiscing about the last time they fought, bragging about their many kills. Others, the older ones, stay quiet, completely focused on the mission, staring into space.
"Do you think we'll get to shoot any guns?"
Ivan asks me. "I doubt it," I reply. We're along for this mission simply because I'm the general's son, and Ivan, his ward. We're too young to be of any real use to the strike team, but not too young to watch the execution of this Loric insurgent from a distance. My father wants us to learn from it. As our instructors always tell us, the combat simulations we run in battle preparedness class, where we do get to shoot guns, are no substitution for the real thing.
"That sucks," grumbles Ivan.
"Whatever," I say, shifting and trying to stretch my legs out. "I just can't wait to get off this plane." Everything next happens in a blur. We land. We find the guard and her sepan. As instructed, Ivan and I hang back, watching, with the general, as the Mogadorian warriors go into battle. It's an ugly thing. Not at all like the battles described in the Great Book. 2 dozen Mogadorians against an old woman and a teenage girl. At first, our goal is simply to capture and interrogate these two. There have been whispers since we came to Earth of some kind of Loric magic that protects the guard, forcing us to kill them in order. There was talk of a battle in the Alps, where one of our warriors had a guard cornered, only to have his killing blow somehow turned against him. The general hasn't tolerated talk of this so-called Loric charm, but my people are still careful. The old woman puts up more resistance than expected, yet she's quickly overwhelmed. The guard is tougher still. She has powers. The ground quaking beneath the feet of our warriors. I wonder what it would be like to have that kind of power. But if the trade-off is to be part of a dying race forced to cower in crappy huts on the banks of a river, I'll pass. The strategy to capture them changes once our warriors realize they can hurt the guard. Either the rumors of the Loric charm are as false as my father believes, or this is number one. The general might have wanted her taken alive. But when the warriors understand that they can kill her, bringing us closer to our goal, bloodlust overcomes orders. It ends when one of the warriors puts his sword through number one's back, impaling her.
"That was awesome!"
shouts Ivan. Even my father allows himself a thin smile of approval. I know I should share in their elation, but my hands won't stop shaking. I feel grateful that I only had to watch from a distance, that I wasn't one of the Mogadorians now reduced to ash on a Malaysian riverbank. I'm also grateful not to be Loric, not to have to spend my life running in fear from impossible odds, only to be stabbed in the back. It occurs to me that I'm feeling something close to empathy for the guard. The Great Book warns against that, so I shut it away. I need to get beyond these childish feelings. The battle was less glorious than I expected, but still, a great victory for Mogadorian progress. Only 8 more loose ends remain, and then Ra's vision will be fulfilled. Nothing will stand in the way of our expansion to Earth. 9 dead guard are a small price to pay for my sweet penthouse at the top of the Washington Monument. They shove number one into a body bag and dump her in the plane with the rest of the cargo. The Loric chest she had with her is taken as well, although even the strongest of our warriors can't pry open the lock. One's pendant is ripped off her body by my father, though I'm not sure what use he has for Loric jewelry. Her sepan's body is left behind. She is of no importance to us now. On the plane ride back, the benches are a lot less crowded. I stay quiet, but Ivan pesters the warriors from the front line for gory details until the general hisses at him to shut up. If they had been a football team, I'm sure the surviving warriors would be dousing each other with Gatorade the way the human athletes do after a win. But we're not a football team. We're Mogadorians.
and my father doesn't even know what Gatorade is. We travel the rest of the way in silence. During the flight, the general comes to sit beside me.
When we get back to Ashwood Estates,
he says,
I have an important task for you.
I nod. Yes, of course, sir. My father looks down at my hands, still shaking no matter how hard I try to steady them.
Stop that,
he growls before heading back to the cockpit. Chapter 4. Although I saw her in the battle, the girl on the metal slab isn't what I was expecting. Ever since the first great expansion, we've been taught that the guard are the last true threat to our way of life. We've been taught that they are fierce warriors, lying in wait to one day take up arms against the engine of Mogadorian progress. Somehow, I thought this threat to my people would look more fearsome. In death, number one doesn't look like much at all. She looks to be around my age or just a bit older, and her skin, once tan, is now bloodlessly pale. Her lips are blue. Streaks of dried blood run through her blonde hair. Her body is covered with a white sheet, but under the bright lights of the laboratory, I can see the grisly shadow of the wound that blossoms across her midsection. We are beneath Ashwood Estates in the underground laboratory of Dr. Lakam Anu. I've never been allowed down here before, so I try to take in as many of the strange, blinking machines as possible without openly gawking. The general would not be kind if he thought I was distracted. I stand next to my father, both of us silent, watching as Anu gently eases one's head into a strange, mechanical helmet. Anu is an old man, his spine hunched, his tattooed scalp disgustingly wrinkled. He circles around one, connecting loose wires to the open diodes that clutter the helmet.
Should be ready,
mutters Anu, stepping back.
Finally,
grunts my father. Anu pauses over one's left ankle, tracing the Loric charm scarred there. What the Loric charm looks like is one of the first things we were taught when we came to Earth. Scrutinizing every bare ankle for its presence became second nature for me long ago.
4 years of searching for a child with this symbol,
muses Anu.
You certainly take your time, General.
I can practically feel my father clench his fists. It's like standing next to a gathering storm. Yet he makes no reply. Dr. Anu heads up the research and science team at Ashwood Estates, and is entitled to certain benefits, like making a dig at the General without being immediately beaten. Anu looks in my direction, his left eye involuntarily drooping and half-lidded.
Did your esteemed father explain why you were here, boy?
I glance at the general. He nods, granting me permission to speak. No, sir.
Ah, sir. What a polite young man you've raised, General.
Anu gestures to a nearby metal chair, over which hangs an imposing piece of complicated technology.
Come, have a seat.
I glance again at my father, but his face gives nothing away.
You will do our family proud today, Adamus,
rumbles the general. I'm relieved that my hands have finally stopped shaking. I sit down. Anu crouches before me, his old bones creaking in protest. He binds my wrists and ankles to the chair with rubber straps. I know that I should trust my father. I'm too important for him to let anything bad happen to me. Still, I can't help but squirm a bit as I'm buckled in.
Comfortable?
Asks Dr. Anu, smirking at me. What is this? I reply, forgetting the general's rule against asking questions. My father gazes at me with surprising patience. Maybe he's as uncomfortable seeing his only son being strapped down as I am being strapped.
Dr. Anu believes this machine will let us access the Loric girl's memories,
explains my father.
I know that it will,
corrects Anu. He rubs a warm liquid on my temples before connecting a pair of rubber electrodes. The
the electrode wires run to a monitor positioned next to number one, which suddenly hums to life.
"Would you stake your life on this untested creation, Dr. Anu?"
growls my father. "Untested," I start. Jerking against my bonds, I immediately regret the note of panic in my voice. It causes the general to grimace. Dr. Anu flashes me a placating smile.
"We never had one of the guard to experiment on before, so, yes, untested."
He shrugs merrily, excited to test this contraption.
"But the theory behind it is very strong. Of the trueborns here in Washington, you are closest in age to the girl, which should make the memory download go more smoothly. Your mind will interpret the guard's memories as visions rather than through her eyes. I'm sure your father wouldn't suddenly want his only son in the body of a little girl, hmm?"
My father bristles. Dr. Anu glances over his shoulder.
"Just kidding, General. You have a good, strong son here. Very brave."
At the moment, I don't feel very brave. I'd watched number one get struck down. She was barely capable of defending herself in life. She is certainly harmless in death, yet being connected to her, it renews the feeling of unease I felt on the plane ride back from Malaysia. I almost start to volunteer Ivan to be Anu's guinea pig, but clamp my mouth shut just in time. Ivan enjoyed watching one die. It's all he's been able to talk about. For me, even thinking about it makes my hands start to shake again. I steady myself. "Stop being such a coward, Adamus. This is a great honor, something I should be proud of." I try not to look at the dead girl as Anu reaches above the chair and lowers a metal cylinder down from the ceiling, covered with circuitry that wouldn't look out of place on the inside of a rocket. The vast majority of the wires connected to number one connect to the cylinder. Anu pauses before the cylinder is in place over my head and peers down at me.
"You'll feel a little shock," he muses. "Maybe go to sleep for a few minutes. When you wake up, you'll be able to tell us what this one knew about the other guard."
I realize Anu's free hand is on my shoulder. His grip is tight. A few days ago, my biggest worry was dumbing down essay answers enough to pass my work off as Ivan's. Since then, I've seen firsthand the Mogadorian warrior I'm expected to grow into. And I'm not sure I'm up for it. Now, I'm being ordered to temporarily share a brain with my mortal enemy. I know it's my father's will, and that if the machine works, it will help our cause and bring honor to my family. Still, I don't want to admit it. But I'm scared. Anu lowers the cylinder over my head until it covers my face. He and my father disappear from view. I hear Anu shuffle across the laboratory. His fingers click across a series of buttons, and the cylinder begins to vibrate.
"Here we go,"
announces Anu. The inside of the cylinder explodes with light, searing white light that burns my eyes all the way through to the back of my head. I shut my eyes, but somehow the light still penetrates. I feel as if I'm coming apart, the light tearing through me, breaking me into tiny particles. This is what death must feel like. I think I scream, and then everything is darkness. Chapter 5. It's like I'm falling. Bursts of color flash across my vision. There are shapes, indistinct faces, blurry scenery, but I can't make any of it out. It's like being stuck inside my TV while Kelly plays with the remote. Nothing makes any sense. And I start to get this panicky feeling, like sensory overload. I try to squeeze my eyes shut, but that's useless. This is all happening inside my mind. Just when I feel like my brain is about to be fried to a crisp by the bombardment of colors, everything snaps into focus. Suddenly, I'm standing in a sunlit banquet hall
Light pours into the room via a skylight through which I can see trees unlike any I've ever seen before. Red and orange flowered vines hanging off tangled branches. Although I've never been there, I've only looked down on it from orbit. Somehow, I know that this is Lorien. And then I realize that I know where I am because Number One knows. This is one of her memories. In the center of the room is a large table covered with strange yet delicious-looking foods. Seated all around the table are Lorik, all of them wearing fancy dresses and suits. I flinch when I see them. I'm outnumbered, and my first instinct is to run. Yet, I'm pinned to this spot. I couldn't move if I tried, stuck in this memory. The Lorik are all smiling, singing. They don't seem at all alarmed that a Mogadorian has just appeared at their party. That's when I realize they can't see me. Of course not. I'm just a tourist in Number One's mind. And there she is, seated at the head of the table. She's so young, maybe 5 or 6. Her blonde hair pulled into 2 braids that dangle down her back. When the adults finish singing, she claps her hands in excitement, and I realize this is her birthday celebration. We don't celebrate such foolish occasions on Mogador, although some great warriors are known to mark the anniversary of their first kill with a feast. What a useless memory. The general won't be impressed if all I come back with is intel on Lorik birthday parties. Just like that, the world goes blurry again, and I'm falling. Time passes in a rush, and I'm swept along, feeling sickeningly out of control. Another memory takes shape. Number One wanders through an open field, her hands extended so that the tall grasses tickle her outstretched palms. She's maybe a year older than at the birthday party, still just a child, happily wandering around her undestroyed planet. Boring. One bends down and picks some flowers, twining the stalks together, then wrapping the flower chain around her wrist like a bracelet. How much of this am I going to have to sift through? Maybe if I focus, I can get some control of these memories. I need to see the other guard, not this girly, happy Lorik crap. I try to think about what I want to see. The faces of the guard. Their sepans. And then the memory in the field flashes away, and I am somewhere else. It's nighttime, although the darkness is lit by dozens of fires raging nearby. The 2 Lorik moons hang on opposite sides of the horizon. The ground shakes beneath my feet. An explosion nearby. Number One and 8 other children rush across a secluded airstrip, headed for a ship.
Their sepans hurry them along, shouting orders.
Some of the children are crying as their feet slap against the pavement. Number One is not. She stares over her shoulder as a Lorik in a sleek bodysuit fires a cone of freezing cobalt energy into the face of a snarling piken. Number One's eyes widen in admiration and fear. This is it. The first great expansion. Exactly the memory I need to see.
Run!
The Lorik in the bodysuit shouts at the fleeing group of young guard. His legacies fully developed and powerful. Still, he'll die on this night, just like all the others. I sweep my eyes over the children, trying to take in as many details as I can. There's a feral-looking boy with long black hair and another blonde girl. Younger than Number One, being carried by her sepan. Number One is older than most of the other kids. A detail that I know will help my father construct profiles of the remaining guard. I count how many of them are boys and how many are girls and try to memorize their most distinguishing features.
Who the fuck are you?
The voice is clearer than the thunderous sounds of war from the memory, as if it's being piped right into my brain. I turn my head and realize Number One is standing right next to me. Not the child Number One of the memory. No, this is number one as I last saw her. Blonde hair flowing down her back, shoulders squared defiantly. A ghost. She's looking right at me, expecting an answer. She can't be here. That doesn't make sense. I wave my hand in front of her face, figuring that this must be some kind of glitch in Anu's machine. There's no way she's really seeing me. Number one slaps my hand away. I'm surprised that she can touch me. But then I remember that we're both ghosts here. Well, she asks, who are you? You don't belong here. You're dead, are the only words I can muster. One looks down at herself. For a moment, the massive wound on her abdomen flickers into being. Just as quickly, it's gone. Not in here, she shrugs. These are my memories, so in here, I guess you're stuck with me. I shake my head. It's impossible. You can't be talking to me. One squints at me, thinking, your name is Adam, right? How do you know that? She smirks. We're sharing a brain, Moog boy. Guess that means I know a thing or two about you, too. Around us, the fleeing guard have all boarded their ship, the engines now rumbling to life. I should be scanning the ship for any helpful details, but I'm too distracted by the dead girl sneering at me. Your scary-ass pops is going to be so disappointed when you wake up with nothing juicy to tell him. She grabs me by the elbow, and the feeling is so real that I have to remind myself that this is basically just a dream. A dream that number one is suddenly in control of. You want my memories? She asks. Come on, I'll give you a guided tour. As the scene changes again, I start to understand what's happened. I'm trapped in here with my sworn enemy, and she seems to be in charge.